Scooby-Doo. Hello and welcome to episode 186 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously viciously murdered by other critics and described as whodunits. I am Nick. I am the all-powerful but flawed church of the podcast. And I am joined, as ever, by Roger.
What, you mean we're not going to do the young priest and the old priest?
Oh, yeah. Okay, that would work. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, we are back in whodunit territory, and not just back in whodunit territory. This is the most recent film we've ever discussed, because it's from just last year, as we record, which is Rian Johnson's Wake Up Dead Man, which you could also call Knives Out 3, I guess.
That was its working title.
A Benoit Blanc mystery. So we discussed Knives Out and Glass Onion. Was that in a single episode?
Yes.
Possibly. Because we, as a genre, Roger, you're much more of a fan of whodunits than I am, but we both thoroughly enjoyed both of those films, I must say. So we thought we'd try out Wake Up Dead Man.
This was on the cards at the time, but had not yet been produced. We actually have history on our podcast now. This is amazing.
Yes, we do. We're referring back to ourselves. And I guess just enough time has passed that this feels almost long enough ago that we could do Wake Up Dead Man. It is another very modern and very different to the other two in theme.
Yeah,
probably so in style.
This is what I like first. I mean, Rian Johnson is director of all three. We've got the same star in all three, but they have quite different feelings.
They do. So this one, so we had Knives Out, which was kind of a classic Manor House whodunit style
film. The old rich guy has died. Various people think they're going to be the heir.
And that was very sort of Agatha Christie adjacent. And then we had Glass Onion, which was very different feel of kind of modern influencers and billionaires. And we liked sort of Benoit Blanc's exasperation at the idiocy of modernity in a lot of ways. And this is much more, well, it's very gothic, certainly in style. It's full of towering stone edifices and darkness and rain and religious symbolism. So it's very different to the other two.
Yeah, arguably elements of P.T. James in here. She did love her writing about religion. She's the sort of person that priests get warned about who wants to be a part of the church, and you must not let her because she will take it over and right. Remake it in her own image.
This was Children of Men, P.T.
No, no, I'm thinking of the religious adjacency in her Adam Dalgliesh detective stories.
Okay. It's interesting. I do sort of feel sympathy with Rian Johnson because to me, again, I'm a bit of a novice to the genre. I read some Agatha Christie when I was young. I liked them. I overdosed on them and sort of haven't really gone back to whodunits since then. But it strikes me that you can't just do a whodunit, you know, because they've all been done. You've got to do something new with it. But I don't know how you do that with all of them. You know, with the whole history of it. Maybe that's me as a novice. Is that how you feel coming to these kind of stories?
Well, I mean, I would start off by saying, while I enjoy many things that are whodunits, there are an awful lot of whodunits I would not enjoy and generally right. try to avoid. People ask me sometimes on the blog, why did you review all these things you hate? And the answer is, I didn't think I was going to hate it. If I had, I wouldn't have read it.
But yes, well, that's the same with, it's rare we watch a film. Well, we don't watch a film with the intention of disliking it. Same idea.
But, and on the one hand, there are definitely conventions, and sometimes I obviously won't mention specific stories, but Agatha Christie violated those conventions on several occasions. The assumption is that one person done it and the detective will catch them. And sometimes she did the narrator done it. Sometimes she did everybody done it. Sometimes she said, okay, well, yeah, they'll just get away with it.
It's a murder on the Orient. Oh, sorry, spoiler. I'll shut up.
But there are definitely conventions, and I think that there is that light structure which is pleasant in its way. What I tend to look for is not so much the technical clueology as it might be, you know, could somebody have been there if they were on that train then, that kind of thing.
Right.
As the character, you know, is, if a murder was done in this particular way, who is the person who would A, do the murder, and B, do it in that particular way at that particular time, and so on. And I like that depth of character when it's present. That's really what I read for.
So do you feel cheated if it turns out everyone done it, or it was a way that it was done that you couldn't, there was no way you could have predicted that?
Somewhat, yes. I mean, there have been various attempts to write rules for murder mysteries, and Knox and Van Dyne both did it, and there have been various other ones since. But I think it's generally understood that if you're going to introduce something weird, then in order to be playing fair with the reader, you have to mention that something weird exists, rather than saying, aha, I wished him to death from the next room with my black magic powers.
Yes, that would have been a surprise. But I guess it's perfectly fine for that to be played with as the character's thinking, whoa, could this actually be a psychic thing? But you'll actually be cheated if it isn't a mundane explanation.
Well, also Larry Niven did this when he was writing SF Detective Stories, the Gild the Arm stories.
Right.
There are particular bits of technology that are key to how the murder works, but they have to be introduced so that the reader is aware that they exist. This is basically what I call the game side of the story. And what I look for is one that has the game and the characters. And I want to enjoy both.
Yes, yeah. Well, it sort of brings us on to the actual story. And I guess we should emphasize, particularly in this one, there will be spoilers. This is quite a recent film, so I would not listen further if you haven't watched the film. Other than, I think it's fair to say, if you're going to stop here, we did both enjoy it, and I think it's fair to say both would recommend you watch it. As far as whodunits go, I am not good at the game side at all. So I guess what I am coming for, as you say, is the characters and the interest, and I've got to believe the characters. That certainly worked for me in Wake Up Dead Man. I was completely clueless for the whole actual plot, I must say, but the characters kept me going through it because it's got some really compelling performances, and interesting characters. In fact, the whole opening, the first third of the film, if we sort of sink into the plot a little bit, Benoit Blanc isn't in it, nearly an hour, I think, which, again, that didn't confuse me. It felt sort of in keeping with the way these films work and the way it definitely felt like a Rian Johnson film, by which I mean it definitely felt directed by the same person as the other two, and written by the same person, in that it's got the same kind of...
The style is taken off at a completely different story, which is the young priest goes to the parish and shakes things up.
Yes.
Which is a story we've come across before.
Yes, and it's very... I don't know if we actually find it. It's got a very New England feel. I'm not sure quite where it is. Oh, it is. It's New York, isn't it? Yeah, so it is New England. So we have Father Judd Duplicity? Was that his name? I don't remember them mentioning that. Josh O'Connor. I think he's great in this.
I haven't seen him in anything else, but I do think he's sunk into the character very, very effectively.
Yes, absolutely. Like, we're opened up with him, you know, the first thing we see him do is punching someone. And so you're kind of almost led to believe this is going to be a man driven by anger. It does well, this film, because it talks about one of the themes of the film is kind of different aspects of Christianity. So we have the kind of forgiveness and humanity of Christianity embodied by Father Judd. As we discover through the film, he is much more forgiving and compassionate and open to, you know, opening your heart and understanding that things done in anger are probably not going to turn out well. And then we have the kind of fire and brimstone side of the Catholic Church, which is Josh Brolin, who is also excellent here as the father. I've forgotten his name now. He is
Wicks.
Monsignor Wicks, who's this real firebrand, and almost I mean, again, there's certainly a comment to be made on modern American politics here as well.
Well, particularly, I think it's worth bearing in mind that Johnson grew up in evangelicalism, brackets American, obviously.
Yeah.
And was originally going to set it in that, and a lot of the script does rely on that. But then he realised that actually most evangelical churches kind of look like Pottery Barn, and he wanted something more visually impressive.
Right.
The problem is that the thing that you lose going there is that the evangelical system essentially doesn't have formal hierarchy. So, yeah, there is nobody who can tell the local pastor you're out of line, stop doing that.
Right.
Whereas the Catholic system does have that, and is very ready to use it. Not perhaps in all the places we might want them to, but they certainly do it. They would be keeping a much closer eye on things.
And so this idea of him going there and this Monsieur being a law unto himself probably wouldn't happen in the Catholic Church.
Or at the very least, there would be a whole lot more awareness of what's going on. And if he's still doing that, then they are approving of his doing that. Because somebody would have had a word with him otherwise.
Which
from
I
a position of authority, not just sending in the new guy to see what you can find out.
It's sort of implied that he's been sent there to try and find out a bit more about what's going on. But I agree that he gets no backup. He's basically there on his own, sent by the one cardinal, I think, or bishop. I don't know the ranks very well in the Catholic Church. But Geoffrey Wright, I think it was, as the cardinal.
Yeah, he is a bishop, but this is not a... this is not a full bad either church, sort of church hierarchy, so.
Anyway, it moves into this perfect setup because what we have the story of the first, the first few months of Father Judd's, exploration of the church, and then it starts to begin to resemble a more of a whodunit because what we have is a very small congregation, at five or six people, and we get to learn all their characters and what they're about. And at this point, it becomes clear that they're being set up to be the suspects.
But they are also, whether they realise it or not, all basically feeding the priest in some way or another, whether that's money or adoration or something else.
I mean, he is a great monster, the Monsignor. He's this full of rage and anger, and this is how we're going to fight back. And that, you know, there's definitely more than a hint of MAGA in Father in the Monsignor, and Father Judd is you know, you could argue perhaps that's reading too much into it, but I don't think it's a coincidence that this character is somewhat Trumpian in nature. And then we have these followers who are almost they are, you know, disciples. It's almost, this little church has almost become a cult with him as the leader, with a small group of people.
Mm.
I didn't think there was a weak link in the acting at all.
Did get the impression that compared with the first two films, it's a bit less of an all-star roster. I mean, that yes, there are big names here, but they aren't all big names.
Yes, I liked that too as well. I mean, as you say, I've not seen, it may be us that are a bit out of date, but I've not seen Josh O'Connor before. We do have Glenn Close, as Martha.
Excellent.
She was excellent. I suppose the slight problem there is Glenn Close is such a well-known star that I was pretty suspicious, right from the start that she would be heavily involved, in the murder. We don't know what the murder is initially, but perhaps that was an issue that she was too, too powerful. But again, we had Thomas Hayden Church in as the groundskeeper, Sam. Again, excellent. I've usually seen him as kind of angry alpha males. But here he's, I don't know, he's quite a sweet, they're all well-rounded character. I mean, again,
there's definitely some playing against type. Jeremy Renner as the alcoholic doctor whose wife left him.
Yes, and kind of, they all talk about
him. This is the sort of role where critics usually say, oh, he's so brave putting on all that weight.
Yes, I mean, he has just recovered from running over himself with his snowplow, to be fair. So it's nice to see him mobile. But yes, they all talk about this kind of little weak man. This is the guy, you know, who played Hawkeye and is quite not an intimidating Shereen Pleasant, but yeah, certainly playing against time. But I absolutely agree. Less star-studded. And all for the better, I think, because then you can just enjoy these really quite good character actors.
Yes, I would also say that with the first two, I'm not that. Most of the films I watch are for this, so I'm not seeing a face and thinking, "Oh right, it's that guy." I may find them familiar, but I don't generally leap to their previous roles.
Yes.
And honestly, many of the big name actors are very, very good. And I liked the fact that they got to do that rather than be the big name lead character stereotype.
I have to say, it seems quite evident to me Daniel Craig's enjoying this way more than he enjoyed James Bond, as far as I can tell.
Doesn't have to punch anybody.
Yes, exactly. He just seems to be having a whale of a time. Again, when Benoit, so we get to the point of the murder, which is
an impossible crime.
It's so this is the setup for this one. It's a locked room mystery that the kind of study in Scarlet. Someone has been killed almost in plain sight. No one could get near them. So the Monsignor is in a little side. There's probably a special name for it in the Catholic Church, but he's in a side cabinet during. A sermon while Father Judd is doing it. Father Judd glances over, the father has collapsed, and by the time he's got there, there's a knife in his back. And there was no one there. Everyone could see. It's
specifically Father Judd could see. Nobody else could.
Yes, which is why... which is when Benoit Blanc turns out, and this is why Father Judd is the suspect, because no one else really could have done it except him running in and stabbing him in the back. And so it sort of revolves around this locked room mystery. We have Benoit Blanc as this. Again, he looks quite different to his other versions of Benoit Blanc, but he's still clearly... He's got the same sparkle in his eye. He's the same character, clearly. He likes reinventing himself. And so the film becomes Or it feels like it's going to be about, and I guess this is what I mean about whodunits. It feels like, I suppose it just makes me slightly weary that it feels like it really has to do something special, to wrong foot you and put you in a, because it has to be, it can't just be a whodunit. So in this case, it slightly wrong foots you into whether it even was a locked room mystery, or not. An impossible crime. And I don't know. I don't know if I found that slightly weird. For me...
The setup is a bit artificial, I agree.
Yeah. But again,
in the sense that it is
convention.
A work of artifice. It's clearly... Yes. I mean, diegetically, yes, this was, as it will turn out, this was set up to look like an impossible crime, deliberately.
Yes.
And there are some things I'm not entirely clear about, but it's not... It doesn't completely arise from the characters.
Well, I think this is, looking back on it, and I didn't watch it many days ago, what I remember is the characters and the imagery and the gothic nature. The actual details of the plot, which, again, is certainly past fridge logic, you know, I didn't think, hang on, but all of it made sense. But it was a touch too convoluted for me. And I guess that's the whole point of these kind of films in a way. It's not the whole point. It just felt to me a bit of window dressing, because actually what Rian Johnson is clearly interested in is the characters. And in particular, in this case, the kind of notion of, forgiveness and guilt and anger. And it has some interesting things to say about religion. What I quite like about this. So I don't know about going through the convolutions of the plot, because it does get a bit complicated. But I found it had some interesting things to say about religion, and
well,
I like that...
Specifically, I mean, Blanc is an atheist and remains so, I'm glad to say.
Mm-hmm.
But comes to a point where he has realised what is going on, And instead of pointing the finger, just says to everyone, "I cannot solve this crime." He doesn't say it was clearly a miracle, but he lets people assume that.
Yes, basically a bit of trickery in that. Yes,
this is as it happens, and as he clearly knows at the time, as an avenue to allow the real criminal to confess,
and specifically confess. Not in public, but in a private sort of a confessional, because he knows that will give her much more. He basically, it's interesting, he, as the rational detective, he recognises the value of religion in this sort of context and the value of forgiveness and compassion. He recognises that this is not his bailiwick, and he lets Father Judd take over at that point.
Yeah.
And I did really appreciate it. I mean, that was not quite where I was expecting to go as a whodunit. It's not Benoit Blanc, who obviously had solved it all quite quickly and knew what was going on. But, it turns out to be Martha who has killed the Monseigneur, and she's killed the Monseigneur because he has betrayed her trust, because again, there is an incredibly valuable jewel involved, and he...
Yeah, no, this is where we start to get a little iffy. Okay, so this is the thing that would work better if it were still evangelical, because there was the previous grandfather?
Who
has to be a reverend, not a Catholic, because he had a daughter. Official one. So basically he had lots of money. He founded the church, I think. And his daughter, who was a bad girl, basically was bribed into staying near him and not going off and having her own life by being told that she would inherit everything.
Yes.
And then when he dies, she discovers that he legally speaking had nothing left. It will become clear that he had sunk it all into one great big diamond. And now this is where I would appreciate a technical point. It turns out that he swallowed that diamond.
Now I was assuming it was covered in poison, but didn't they do an autopsy?
And then immediately died.
Yeah.
Now it seems to me, I realise this is upstate New York; it's not the big city. If you know, here is a man in relatively good health who has suddenly died, you would put. Possibly through an obstruction of the breathing, you might check that whether there is anything obstructing the breathing as part of your routine examination.
I mean, we talked about this in A Simple Plan, but any suspicious death, there would be an examination by the coroner. And it's a pretty poor coroner who doesn't investigate the intestinal tract.
Oh, there's this hard lump. I wonder what that is.
I mean, whether they then told anyone about it after they found an enormous diamond, I don't know.
Ooh, nothing there. And the coroner retired to Hawaii.
I agree. The idea that this was caught in the corpse, that didn't ring true to me.
But the plot flows from this because Grace... Sorry, no. Grace is the wayward daughter.
Grace is the bad
Martha. Very, very significant name there. The one who does all the labour and doesn't get rewarded.
Yes,
in the biblical sense.
Okay.
She was aware that was where the jewel was, and she was just keeping quiet about that until Father Judd came along and challenged her to confess her greatest sin.
Which she does to the Monseigneur.
By accident.
And,
because close confessional and all that. But I mean, the priest on the other side of the confessional does actually talk to you.
Yeah. Okay, so she doesn't...
You don't just whisper into the darkness.
But she realises the error she's made because the Monseigneur is then consumed by the sin of greed.
Yeah, he has his own bastard son, who is a wannabe politician and influencer type.
Yes, again, a thinly veiled comment on some character
who has been building up Monsignor Wicks as this great big firebrand, telling it like it is type. Mm. And he decides that, you know, working together with huge amounts of money, they can make something really big out of it. And that is the point at which the murder plot is hatched by Martha, when she realises that this is what's going to happen.
The
timing matters. This is on the Palm Sunday, and the death is on the Good Friday. So the Sunday to the next Friday.
Well, her idea is to basically stage this as a miracle, because not only can she get rid of the Monsignor and eliminate the risk to the church, she can also rejuvenate the church's fortunes by creating this miracle.
Yeah, because basically the Monsignor has been driving away anybody in the congregation who wouldn't become one of his personal cult.
Mm. So again, it's quite a convoluted plot. Why she couldn't just take the diamond herself if she really wanted to reverse the fortune? But again, she
there is this crypt that cannot be opened.
Except from the inside.
Yeah, but it's complicated to open from outside and needs heavy machinery, so she can't just take it and run.
But, and this is how she knows the Monsignor is after the diamond, because he has ordered said heavy machinery to get into the crypt. And at that point, she realises what he's going to do. And the plot is hatched from there. So her idea is to make it appear as an impossible crime. She enlists the help of Jeremy Renner's character, the local doctor, who is weak and bitter. I mean, they all embody sins of some kind of pride and envy and greed. I don't know if it's quite as specific, but they all are all deeply flawed characters, except Father Judd, who, as it turns out, has murdered before, in that he killed someone in the ring. He didn't go to prison for it because it looked like an accident, but he constantly through the film refers to knowing what he was doing. You know, he did it with hate in his heart, and he knew.
And that is, as it turns out, is what put him on the road to becoming a priest.
Yes. I do like this. I mean, I was surprised how it has this very compassionate view of religion, because, you know, even, you know, the bad daughter, it has time for her, and particularly Father Judd has time for her, and his first reaction to hearing of her tale and how she reacted is one of compassion and sorrow and understanding how she got to that place. He's like a really, he is like, I am not religious, but he really does embody the things about Christianity that would be attractive to me. Mm. Forgiveness and compassion and open-mindedness. And I really do think, you know, that there are echoes of the current situation in America, and it's, I feel like it's trying to say something about how best to handle that, or at least, you know, there is another path other than anger and hatred. I found it surprisingly, well, not surprisingly, because he is already a filmmaker that we both kind of trust now. The whodunit.
I haven't seen anything else by him.
Well, he did The Last Jedi, of course, which was the Star Wars
hated
film that
by the fans,
hated.
But honestly, given the other things the fans have said, I honestly don't know whether that's a good or a bad sign.
Well, it's the one that actually is, you know what, it doesn't matter about your heritage, you don't have to be a Skywalker or anything, you can be special, and everyone hated that because they all wanted it. So immediately they retrofitted it in the next film, yeah. And basically reproduced Return of the Jedi. But it is, in my opinion, the best of the last trilogy, which is not saying much.
So things that didn't work so well for me, one, honestly, when I saw both Josh Brolin and Thomas Hayden Church as Monsignor Wicks and the caretaker, I found them both looking very like Jeff Bridges doing the dude. It is, in fact, later a plot point that they look somewhat like each other, but...
Yes, yeah, that's fair enough, yeah.
One of the key things is the knife that Father Judd finds in Monsignor Wicks's back is attached to a distinctive devil's head finial.
From the local pub.
which he had stolen from the local pub in a drunken rage that previous Palm Sunday.
Mm.
That chucked into the bushes. Now, I feel there's less story than there should be. I think, did they use the other one to make the knife? Presumably they did.
Yes.
Did they know they were going to be dobbing in Father Judd as the guy who was known to have broken the lamp and taken the finial?
Well, that was not clear to me. Was that widely known? Was that a big thing?
Yeah, there are certainly answers here. I feel that just the film didn't give the answers.
It's not like that couldn't make any sense, but I agree that it didn't seem to, for something that became a significant plot point, it didn't, but I suppose that's a tricky thing with the whodunit. You want to draw attention to something, but you don't want to be like, this is important, because the whole game is, what's important and what's not. What's a red herring?
And red herrings are definitely part of the genre. I can't argue with that.
But it's got to make more sense in retrospect. And I agree that in retrospect, it almost breaks under fridge logic.
There is also Roger's Drugs Corner, which, to be fair, I think most people wouldn't be aware of or particularly worry about if they did, which is pentobarbital, which is used as a knockout and as a killing drug at various points in this.
In veterinary medicine, we use it as the euthanasia drug.
Yeah, it has other uses as well, but it is generally in humans, it is the standard euthanasia drug in the Netherlands, for example.
Yes.
But it is generally you give an antiemetic first, because like many depressants of that sort, and alcohol do the same thing, you'll start vomiting first as your body tries to get rid of this obvious poison. So
it's not much. That said, I have not usually given it orally. To be fair,
if used covertly in this way, you really want a 2 days dose thing. Otherwise, people would be throwing up all over the place, and that would be a bit of a giveaway.
I don't know how quickly it acts orally.
A lot of it depends on the dose,
right? But again, the taste of it is quite bitter. But that is because they deliberately put that into a euthanasia drug because they don't want you to get it. You don't want to drink much of it. I've no idea what it tastes like as an oral formulation. Probably better than that. Anyway, let's move on.
That has been Roger's Drugs Corner.
I can confirm it does make your lips go numb, though. having accidentally injected it into my lips once or twice. Anyway, never mind that.
So would you say it's bitter like onions or more bitter like...
Maybe we should write a hoodoo. Anyway, yes.
There is also a bath of cinematic acid, but eh.
Yeah, I think that was when the doctor was involved and that it just crept into... also, Martha, she's clearly very capable. She's holding the church together, but at no point are we given the indication that she has the kind of mind that is devious enough to come up with this very convoluted plot.
Ah, now I assumed that for two reasons. One, she was played by Glenn Close.
Yes, exactly.
But also, two, I have met the one woman who is allowed to have anything to do with the church a few times, and generally she is extremely devious because she has to be to get through this violently misogynistic system at all, even to the extent she has.
Well, I certainly was on board that she was extremely capable and probably the cleverest person in the church. I didn't get the, I mean, the whole plot is quite, baroque, and fanciful. And she seemed like quite a grounded character. But that said, she's also deeply, deeply religious. So, I mean, all these things we're saying are fairly minor quibbles. As a watch, it's genuinely enjoyable.
Yeah, there is a, Shout out for mystery readers to John Dixon Carl's The Hollow Man, which is canonically the novel which lays out all the ways to do a locked room murder.
So this is the book they're quoting from. So yeah. If you're familiar with that, you would have known. So in the film, Blanc deliberately leaves out the one which would obviously implicate Father Judd. So if you're familiar with the book, you might well have already been ahead of him and noticed that he missed that one out.
But I particularly like the way that, you know, he realizes that, aha, so somebody has been reading this book. It was the cult's book club pick last month.
Yes, exactly.
They've all read it.
They all done it. It's a really good film. I liked the depth. I thought it had a surprisingly, I don't know if Rian Johnson is atheist now. I think he is, but it had a very, well, it had an interest.
Ex-evangelicals are, and he is certainly ex-evangelical.
Yes, I would. But it has, I don't know, we don't nowadays in these troubled times think about one of the core messages of Christianity, which is, you know, forgiveness and compassion. And I thought that was a really, it was a really nicely demonstrated way of how to be a muscular, compassionate Christian in the shape of Father Judge. You know, he's not weak. He's not, lily-livered. He's a strong character. And
also inheriting was it Gene Hackman's priest in the Poseidon Adventure?
Yes.
Who similarly is one of those, you know, he tells it like it is rather than going along with your rules, man.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I'm not saying he's a clone of that, but I think he owes something to that tradition.
Well, I think it's interesting. I've been rewatching Firefly and the Shepherd in there, Shepherd Book. It's a very Joss Whedon idea of how to be tough and compassionate, which is funny, and I like it. For instance, we have the Lord doesn't like killing. He is, however, somewhat fuzzier on the subject of kneecaps. It's funny, but it's not, you know, it's not really realistic. Whereas he, you know, it's a typical Joss Whedon kind of, this is how you're tough. What I really appreciate here is this is a more mature, strong character. I don't know. I really like the Father Jug character. Yeah. I like the Benoit Blanc interaction. I certainly will watch any more of these that they plan to make.
As I understand it, the contract that was signed after the first film was for two more.
Yes.
So that's now been done. They have talked about more, but there is nothing actually formal at this point.
I imagine the difficulty is coming up with the plot. I don't know. If it takes them a long time to make another one, it's fine. I suspect they will. They all seem to enjoy doing it. By all, I mean Rian Johnson and him, Daniel Craig.
Craig was certainly one of the first people to sign on when this was mooted, so.
My only ask is, it may be convoluted, but let's have Jamie Lee Curtis again in the next one.
she makes everything better.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Well, we liked it. Is it a masterpiece? Our old question. That's a trickier one.
I don't feel it left enough of a mark on me, and that's a very subjective judgment. I liked it, but it didn't amaze me.
I think it's one of a series. I can't remember if you thought Knives Out was a mess. I think we did think Knives Out was a
masterpiece. I thought you had a spreadsheet.
I do, but I haven't got it open at the moment. I think I'm with you. Taken as a whole, well, I don't know. I don't know that they do enough new for the genre. I think they're really, really well done examples of whodunits with a bit more depth.
Bearing in mind that in the last few years, I haven't actually seen any of them, but there have been several big budget, all-star Agatha Christie remakes. Mm.
No, I haven't seen any
of
them.
And presumably that is the competition for something like this, or at least it's trying to appeal to a similar audience.
I think it's fair to say they are less well thought of as the Knives Out films.
I would rather see this than Agatha Christie again, because, you know, I've read Agatha Christie. I occasionally read him again, but
if I wanted to, I'd watch the old Murder on the Orient Express one with Sean Connery and the all-star cast, where they all line up and stab it. Sorry, spoiler. Spoiler. It very good. I agree. Really, really good film. The fact that it's not a masterpiece is not in any way a failure of a recommendation.
Yeah, I don't think it's groundbreaking. I don't think anybody will say, I am inspired to make a film by this film in particular.
Yes.
As opposed to by the whole series.
Yeah. You could argue the whole series is modern masterpieces. But this particular film feels like one of a series, a really good one. I don't think it's any, I think they're all really good films in their own rights. I think I heard some people saying this was the weaker of the three. I didn't think so. I thought they were all
maybe,
quite good.
But I didn't think it was noticeably worse. I enjoyed it as I enjoyed the others.
Yeah, I think maybe you could argue that Glass Onion was perhaps the slightly weaker, but...
Well, they're all going in different directions, and exactly, that, as you said, and I think that's a good thing, rather than just say, okay, well, we will have Blanc go to another spooky old house where all the heirs are present where the patriarch has died or whatever.
Exactly. They're all exploring different... Anyway, very good. I look forward to seeing what and if they do with it again. And with that, we shall lock the door on this mystery.
You're the church. I'm the world.